we can see Zionism as, first of all, a mutation of anti-Semitism. It is a response to this predicament that faced European society.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman.
And I'm Asa Winstanley.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Tamara Nassar, associate editor of the Electronic Intifada and the producer of the Electronic Intifada podcast and live stream. My brilliant colleague, Nora Barrows-Friedman, is inviting me to guest host this episode. I'm really excited to be joined by a friend, comrade, and friend of the podcast, Abdel Jawad Omar. Abdel Jawad is a lecturer and a PhD candidate at Bir Zeit University. He is currently teaching in the Philosophy and Cultural Studies Department at Bir Zeit. What I admire about Abdel Jawad's work is that he's capable of providing a reading of the Palestinian question through a bedrock of psychoanalysis, which is rarely done well, and he does it really well. The Israeli military campaign in Gaza, the Israeli genocide in Gaza, has been one of the most destructive and the deadliest in recent history. Israel's military carnage in Gaza has been it's wreaked more havoc than multiple recent wars, including Ukraine's Mariupol, including the Allied bombing of Nazi Germany during the Second World War. Israel has been dropping bunker buster bombs on highly populated, very densely populated residential neighborhoods in Gaza, wiping out multiple generations of entire Palestinian families. And within that context, with over 20,000 Palestinians killed in the past 80 days, with the death toll of children teetering on nearly half of that, Israel's genocidal campaign has been compared or been described with the language of the Holocaust. The language of the Holocaust has been used by Palestinians braving Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza. It's also been used by the leaders of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, including the spokesperson for the Izz al-Din Qassam Brigades, the armed military wing of Hamas, Abu Ubaidah, and the political bureau chief in Qatar of Hamas, Ismail Haniya. They've both used that terminology. They have referred to it as al-mahraqa, which roughly translates to a Holocaust or a burning or a whole burning in Arabic. So the Gaza Strip has also been compared to a concentration camp or an open air prison. It's been called a death camp or a ghetto. Israel has also used the memory of the Holocaust to justify its crimes in the Gaza Strip. I'd like to have a conversation with you, Aboud, about a range of topics, but chief among them is I'd like to interrogate this idea of European history and memory, the relations of debt or the politics of debt in Europe. You wrote on Twitter the other day something very interesting. You said, quote, "I am not sure the German and European collective guilt blinds it from seeing what is happening in Palestine. In fact, I think the opposite is true. European subjectivity takes delight in seeing its historical victims becoming oppressors. That is how conditions for psychological redemption are created. It's not in turning away or in historical and collective guilt acting as a barrier for seeing and bearing witness. It is this guilt that propels an attitude that secretly wishes to tell Israel, show us more, show us what you can commit. Aboud, what do you think Israel represents in the European collective, public, and historical imagination? How do you think the European and specifically German public experiences witnessing Israel commit this genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip?
I mean, thank you, Tamar, first of all, for the introduction and for hosting me again. I'm more than happy to be with you. But I think, look, it's a very complicated ground that we're trying to broach talk about. The notion of what Israel represents in this collective European imaginary, or what also Israel and the Arabs represent together, is one that is complicated, because at one point in that, you know, long history of Europe relating to its own Jews, there is the fact that Europe turned its own Jews to the internal enemy, no? The other who needs to be abjected, who needs to be forced out of Europe, the European that cannot stay within Europe, you know, and that took a turn with Nazism and National Socialism, where being removed from Europe meant the systematic industrial killing of many of those others, including Jews, within the boundaries of Europe in the Holocaust. So we had this industrial mass killing of Jews, or, you know, the alternative was in many also anti-Semitic discourses was that Jews need in this colonial moment to find a place outside of Europe where they can, create their own, let's say, European colonial experiment, whether it's in Palestine or Uganda or Argentina or other places that were studied. It was shared between many of the then Zionist leaders like Herzl and many of the, let's say, anti-Semitic foreign policy voices within the British Empire, and even among some of the Germans or some of the French policymakers that saw within the idea of a Jewish state outside of Europe a solution to what was termed in Europe a Jewish problem. So that was, I mean, this is the background of Israel. I think we can see Zionism as, first of all, a mutation of anti-Semitism. It is a response to this predicament that faced European societies with the whole notion of an original sin that ties Jews to the killing of Jesus, and that moves throughout the Middle Ages and transforms into this kind of anti-Semitism in the more modern age, where the Jew is always placed in question within the European collective imaginary. But alongside that, I mean, and I think it's important historically to also situate that the Arab has also been transformed. The Arab, the Muslim, has always been also the external enemy. So there's that kind of internal enemy in the figure of the Jew, and then there's the external enemy in the figure of the Arab or the Muslim, the one that threatens Europe from outside of Europe, the one that threatens European culture, society, and even philosophical development. And of course, in many instances, what we can see in Europeans, how they render this history, is that they render it as always a form of enmity, clash of civilization, cultures, etc. Very few people attempt to also look at how these cultures, you know, had a lot of intercourse and, how they're folded within together in the Mediterranean and how they interacted. Sometimes they allied themselves. I mean, it wasn't always this figure of perhaps enmity in this long history that binded, you know, Europeans and Arabs. But in many ways, I mean, we can say that the Jew was the internal enemy, while the Arab was and remains also to some degree in kind of a collective, perhaps more hidden part of European consciousness, the external also enemy. So Israel in many ways comes into the fold in a very late colonial period. As Tony Judd says, you know, one of the problems with Israel is that it creates its colonial project late in colonialism. late in terms of the world moving away from colonialism. In this moment, you have, you know, this desire from European, specifically Central European Jewry, to come and create a state within the boundaries of Palestine, a Jewish state or a state for the Jews, which always meant that the indigenous people of the of Palestine will be displaced, ethnically cleansed, murdered, massacred, killed, either seen through the lens of the colonial gaze, which was in many instances linked Palestinians to the, you know, to the natural scenery. So they didn't see us. They see us as part of like the animals, the birds, the natural grounds of Palestine itself. Or they saw us as an enemy, an obstacle that has to be taken care of for a state to be created on the expense of the Palestinian people and their long historical existence in Palestine, based on a lot of the mythology that, of course, Zionism spews. And a lot of it, and one of the things that are very particular about Zionism, at least as a colonial movement, is that it's very pragmatic when it comes to how it actually justifies itself ideologically. You know, in different periods, you can see it saying to itself, we're colonialists, but we're also indigenous to Palestine. So we're an indigenous colonizers of Palestine. That's one of the things that, for instance, Joseph Massad talks about it in the persistence of the Palestinian question of how Zionism produced itself both as a European colonialist movement, but at the same time as an indigenous movement liberating through its colonialism the land of Palestine from its own indigenous people, the Palestinians. So you have a lot of these ideological maneuvers within Zionism in an attempt to juggle itself in a way to try to nativize itself in the land of Palestine through religious claims or through whatever claim that it holds. And on the other hand, also still linking itself to European ideological modes of thinking in the historical moment that, you know, exists. So for in the 20s, it's a colonialist movement. It's a progressive socialist movement at some instances. Sometimes it's a religious fundamentalist movement. Sometimes it's presented as a liberal beacon, a democracy, a state, a startup state. So it has all these different myriad, different representations that link well with whatever, you know, the empire highlights or centers in terms of its discourse. And the Israelis are very adept at, you know, placing their own claims on Palestine within whatever frame actually works. I mean, just to recapture some of what we were trying to say, I think that for Europeans, there is a delight on one level. The first level is a delight to see Arabs and Jews, the cousins, in, you know, the collective imaginary of Europe's, balloting it out, no? And, you know, there's that delight of these Semitic people, let's put it that way, these cousins, the internal enemy and the external enemy, you know, fighting each other out over land and going into these historical kind of biblical religious fights that have turned this figure of the Jew against the Arab and the Arab against the Jew. There is that kind of delight in the European psyche to see that kind of drama play out. It's almost as if it's, you know, a 24-hour biblical drama that resurrects a lot of the Christian imaginary as well in terms of how, you know, Arabs are figured. Of course, here Arabs are not necessarily Muslim, but Arabs and Jews, you know, committing acts of murder against each other, hating each other, displacing each other. So there's that one level of it that is very raw. It's tied, if we want, to biblical imaginary. And I think it still persists and exists in many ways, you know. Oh, those Arab and Jews, you know. killing each other, kind of in a dismissive way, not being able to live together, not being able to coexist together. This is all part of like how all, also Europe constructs, I mean, the current moment. But then comes also the history of, let's say, anti-Semitism and the particular history of how Europe dealt with its own Jews into the fold. And I think here with Germany specifically, we have a unique disposition that, you know, a lot of people have placed it as collective guilt. You know, Germany now includes the security of the state of Israel as part of the rationale for the existence of the, you know, the German nation. So that means that, you know, modern German identity after World War II is constructed around the memory of the Holocaust, but also is constructed persistently around the security of the Jewish state, or of Israel in this case. So you have a state that says part of my existence, part of the rationale, the justification for the existence of a German nation is not the German language or culture or perhaps history. It's the existence and security of another state outside even the boundaries of Europe itself. This is what it's, you know, what German is, or modern Germany is proclaiming to be part of the rationale tied to this politics of memory and tied to this notion that there's a depth relationship here, where the Germans and the European collectivity has to pay to the Jewish people. And in this instance, the Jewish people are represented by the state of Israel. So for me, I mean, of course, I think that level of it, that level of seeing a state justify its existence through the persistence of another state is already eerie enough. No? Let's not talk about, like, you know, Palestinians, indigenous rights, whether we have a right to Palestine or not, but just a state claiming or proclaiming that its own existence and rationale for existence is the existence of another state is already very eerie, and you know, you don't see that much in the world. You know, like a state providing, you know, the central ethos of its existence by the existence and the persistence of another state. That's one element. That's one problem of it. The second of it is that there's this claim that this way, the Germans and perhaps the Europeans as a collective are paying back the Jews for the crimes they committed against the Jews. That's the idea also embedded within this notion of backing the state of Israel and its existence and persistence in Palestine, and justifying even the existence of the German nation through it, is that through that, we will actually pay our debt. And this is an unpayable debt. Look, it's a debt that we have to continue paying. It's never-ending debt, but that's the way, that's how we particularize the way that we should pay it. That's the means, this is the methods, the technique of paying that debt is through backing of the Israeli state. Of course, a lot of people have pointed this out. It's not me, within the Jewish world, which says that, first of all, this is, you know, a conflation between Jews and Zionism, a conflation that is in itself anti-Semitic, because it basically says that all Jews are, you know, Zionists, which is not the case. A lot of Jews are anti-Zionists. A lot of Jews stand against the state of Israel in myriad ways. Some want to dissolve it, some see it as, you know, an aberration, some see it as conducting or critique it on the basis of its human rights abuses. You know, so there's a lot of different positions in the Jewish world when it comes to Israel. Some perhaps don't care about it, just don't want to engage. I mean, there's also like the indifference perhaps as a position that could exist also in the Jewish world. So there's all these different positions, and Germany has limited its way of paying the debt to just one single mutation and reaction to anti-Semitism through the lens of Zionism as a form of colonialism that also claims some sort of indigeneity to the Palestinian land. So this is the one direction that the Germans have used or are using to pay its debt. And it's showing, you know, through a lot of cases where Jewish voices that are anti-Zionist are being silenced in Germany. You know? So it tells us one thing about what Germany have chosen in terms of who to back from within the Jewish world. Because unlike what Germans would like to believe or would like to say, this is a choice. No? It's a choice of who you back from the Jewish world. Do you back the anti-Zionist? Do you back the Zionist? Do you back the Jew outside of these kind of considerations? Do you pay the debt in a different way? What it means to hold yourself morally responsible for the Holocaust, at least historically, on today's crimes that Israel is committing in the Gaza Strip? Does that moral responsibility extend to the Palestinians as the victims of the victims in the seen from the German eyes or seen from the German gaze, as what Edward Said once called the Jew of, you know, the Palestinians are the Jews of the Jews, you know? So does that extend to the Palestinians, or does that stop within, or you confine it or foreclose it only in terms of backing Israel as a state and its security through how it self-defines? Does that extend, for instance, to mutations, ideological mutations within Israel? So does that mean that Germany will come and fight a war on behalf of Ben Gvir, for instance, tomorrow? Not the liberal socialist Zionist, not the, you know, the more acceptable form of Zionism with its European, you know, face, but, you know, the religious fundamentalist Zionism that, you know, is also running amok in Palestine. What does that mean? Will Germany come and also back somebody like Ben Gvir or Smotrich, who are outrightly saying they want to ethnically cleanse, who they want to disappear the Palestinian, they want to, you know, wipe out all Palestinians? And despite the fact that we saw in the current moment also all of the Israeli, you know, political machinery saying the same thing. So it, in many ways, I do think that this conscious choice of backing Israel says a lot about, you know, the choice that this collective European imaginary did at some point. It's a convenient choice. It's a convenient choice because, first of all, there's a particular destination to the form of debt relationship you create, and it's Israel. It's a state that has its own interest, you know, like any other state. It has its economic, political interest, it has its national security consideration, it has its politics. It's a state that you can talk to. It's not an abstract notion or a world that is diverse like the Jewish world. So it's convenient to make your amends only through the state of Israel. And it's also convenient because within Zionism, there's also currents that are, you know, that echo, if we want, this German National Socialist past in its practices and the techniques of domination that it also imposes on the Palestinians. And I think on some level here, you know, I always question the fact that, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about, you know, German and European and, you know, they're looking at Palestine, they can't see. They say that they can't see. They're blinded by this collective guilt, you know. They can't hear. So they can't listen to the cries and voices of the Palestinians because they're blinded. There's something preventing them. There's an obstacle preventing them. For me, I do think that that's one possible, you know, way of relating to this, is that because I feel guilty about what we've done to the Jewish, this memory of the Holocaust, this memory of anti-Semitism, that there's something that makes me reserved about hearing Palestinians and questioning whatever they tell me, you know? And that's true. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like somebody, you know, trying to be, you know, encountering, I don't know, the Bible, but wants to find the contradictions within the Bible. Somebody who's, you know, looking at something and is always ready to critique it. He's entering already and encountering a Palestinian on the basis of critiquing the Palestinian and finding any problem with what they're saying. That's probably true, that this kind of line exists, that somehow there's an obstacle because of that history of Europeans seeing what's happening in Palestine. That's part of it. But I do think that, you know, that is not the whole equation. And I think that is already embedded in the choice that the German state made long time ago in practicing a politics of debt exclusively through the relationship with the Zionist state, is that it has chosen a way to absolve itself from its own history through allowing its own victims to become oppressors, and through, you know, making sure that through that process that it can tell its own self, its own, if we want, guilt, that provides some sort of moral, you know, burden and moral responsibility, it can absolve itself from that guilt, because it can look at Israel and it can see Israel transforming itself slowly and steadily into a state that is known for its security and surveillance systems, for its weaponry, for its development of all of these different technologies of dominations and control, of having an AI system that decides who it kills in Gaza and what to hit in Gaza and what to target in Gaza, of, you know, becoming this paranoid state that looks at everything as a threat, and at the same time that practices all these forms of murder in the 21st century in the open. And by the way, you know, I mean, the Europeans are the biggest donors to things like Human Rights Watch, and, you know, these are the people that, you know, document the crime, no? So there's somebody who's always documenting crimes, B'Tselem and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and all of these human rights organizations that come after the crime and document it and make sure that we have records of everything that is being committed in Palestine. And yet, I don't think Europe would be interested in stopping. I mean, that's what politics proved. And it's not because of collective debt burden. It's because, I think, at some level, allow the Jews, our victims, as embodied within the Zionist version of this mutation and reaction to anti-Semitism that existed in Europe, specifically in the 19th and 20th century, but it has a longer history than that, to run amok, to show us more of what they can commit against the Palestinian people. And I think that is in a way the way that this kind of European guilt is removed. It's you know, you meet and encounter a place where you can unburden yourself from the crimes that you committed against the Jews in the mid 20th century, by allowing the Jews to commit crimes in the 20th and 21st century, and they continue. Now in Gaza, it's, you know, it's an undulant, it's going really fast and intense, and that's why I don't think that it's only a matter of not listening and not hearing and not being able to look at the victim in the face. I think it's a matter of seeing and hearing and taking deep pleasure in the fact that your own victims are now oppressors, and that it's not something unique to yourself in the mid-20th century that made you do what you committed, at least in terms. And this runs a bit contradictory to some of the claims that a lot of the Germans and Europeans say when it comes to the Holocaust, that it's a, you know, it's a singular event. There's no other event that resembles it. There's no other genocide that resembles it because of its character, because of how it's done, its industrial nature, you know, the method, the technique that was used. And to some degree, of course, I mean, every event at the end is unique and has its own particular singular, you know, elements that exceed all other, you know, comparisons. But also in many ways, you cannot compare with the Holocaust. And, you know, nobody is allowed in Europe to actually do some sort of comparison, because comparison in of itself, even if you sustain or maintain any type of uniqueness to each event, any type of comparative approach is seen as an equivalence. I mean, I never, you know, you can study logic and you can study a lot of, you know, and Germans are famous for their philosophers, and a lot of them had a lot to do with the development of logic. So, I mean, it's strange to me that comparison is seen as and equivalence. Almost immediately, when it comes to anybody mentioning the Holocaust with any form of, you know, or any other form of ethnic cleansing, genocide, or, you know, crimes committed against any other people in the world. You know, it's not necessarily, when you compare, you're not necessarily trying to create any form of equivalence, but that memory of the Holocaust has been created as something that is so unique, so singular, that nothing else can match it up ever, ever again, in a way that also allows the crimes that are committed in Palestine to always be diluted. So there's two things operating here. On the one hand, you take delight that your victims are becoming oppressors. But on the other hand, these oppressors are never as oppressive as you were. So this is like, this is the contradictory element. So you absolve yourself somehow, but you never reach that kind of moment where you rupture yourself from the burden. No? So you're always burdened because there's this singular, unique event called the Holocaust. And nothing can match with it, no matter, you know, in terms of the method of killing, in terms of its unique industrial nature, etc., etc., etc. And at the same time, you take delight in seeing your victims becoming oppressors, but they can never be as oppressive as you were. They can never, you know, match. And this is what's so dangerous for us Palestinians, because I think that it, you know, on a psychological level, if we analyze it like that, unless the Israelis commit a Holocaust, you know, something that resembles the industrial, you know, they grab us, they put us together, and they start, you know, gassing us and then burning us, you know, replicating that method, our claims for any form of crimes committed on us will always be not enough to get this European subjectivity to feel any sense of guilt or any sense of moral responsibility that extends to the Palestinian subject and figure. It will always meet this obstacle of, I need my victims to become oppressors, but they're never oppressive enough. They're never oppressive enough. Yeah.
I mean, it's this European collective guilt, which, like you said, isn't really blinded to Israel's actions, but fundamentally plays a role in the self-absolvement mechanism, is also interesting, because what's in my understanding and in my reading of this, it's not the crimes themselves of the Holocaust that the Europeans find objectionable, but the victims of the Holocaust. The Holocaust was a manifestation of European criminality, which has existed long before the Holocaust, in a way came home to roost. And this was what was so objectionable about the Holocaust, and also what plays a role and makes it so exclusive and makes the memory of the Holocaust so exclusive and incomparable to anything else. Because the lessons of never again and the lessons of human rights and the lessons of history were never really learned. It's a situation where the crimes themselves are not objectionable. What is objectionable is who gets to commit those crimes and who gets to be at the receiving end of those crimes. Don't you think?
No, of course. I mean, there is a level of, you know, the crime being, for example, spatially in Europe, the Holocaust, no? So that crime took place within Europe, and that is one element to it. Then it also targeted people that are part of the European fabric, Europeans. So, I mean, European Jews were European. So targeted Europeans, you know, on the basis, of course, othering them, you know, creating them as untouchable, undesirable, etc. A lot of these racist tropes that, you know, existed and continue to exist, of course. So there's that uniqueness of how can us, the civilized European, the ones that bear the project of enlightenment, of rationality, of science, of, you know, bringing civilization to the world. That's how colonialism was also for a long time justified, no? That there's on a civilizing mission. That Europeans would themselves commit such a crime within the boundaries of Europe. Remember, I mean, of course, like the Holocaust, you know, was initiated by National Socialism, etc., but a lot of European people participated in it. So it doesn't really confine itself, for instance, in Germany only. It's you know, the crime festers across the European subjectivity as a collective, either by ignoring what was happening, or by not caring, or by participating, or by actually, you know, helping the Nazis at that moment in committing these crimes. That also didn't target only Jews, by the way, targeted other people as well. Mm-hmm. So in many instances, yeah, that particularly is like, how can we face the world as Europeans? The ones who now, you know, as Hegel, you know, history is moving towards Europe, said, you know, the direction of history and its culmination and civilizational claims. And now we, Europeans, commit such a horrendous crime within the boundaries of Europe and against a population of Europeans. So, yeah, a lot of that singularity and uniqueness of how the Holocaust is treated has to do with this kind of this rupture of this kind of enlightenment moment in European history. And of course, Adorno and the Frankfurt School, for instance, they make this point, like that in fact, instrumental rationality, which is very integral part of the European Enlightenment, is responsible for the Holocaust itself, for how it was operated, etc. That it's not an aberration, it's a culmination of this kind of dialectic of Enlightenment that, you know, the Frankfurt School looked at and saw that within the seeds of European thinking and civilizational claims existed also this kind of ugly, horrendous face that, you know, rose or was embodied in the Holocaust as a crime that was done against a defenseless people in within the boundaries of Europe, within the World War II and preceding that. So, yeah, I mean, we can say that there is that kind of like that level of thinking about the Holocaust is that it's a shameful event because of where it happened, place, and against who it happened, as a people, not necessarily against all other peoples, because, you know, a lot of the colonial history, a lot of these countries don't deal with a lot of the massacres they committed in, you know, Africa, or, you know, they don't reckon with this kind of, you know, moral burden and moral responsibility that Europe has in committing a lot of genocides and massacres across the globe, in various places and in various instances. In fact, there's still a persistence of colonial relations, whether it's through economic extraction and surplus. So there's still that level of, you know, of blindness when it comes to a lot of the other historical crimes committed by Europeans across the globe, and also when it comes to the Palestinians, of course, as the victims of the victims, as the people who are oppressed now by the victims of Europeans, at least in one version of the response to anti-Semitism embodied within Zionism as a means to protect the Jews from the horror that the Europeans can inflict. You know, let's remember, I mean, when Israel was conceived, the only reason why it wasn't conceived as a state that is possibly within Europe itself, first of all, because there was rampant colonialism at that moment, and second of all, because there was something called the Jewish problem, because Europeans couldn't deal with having a Jewish population within their own boundaries. There's a lot of hate, a lot of, you know, mythology around Jews and their role in their societies. They were constructed as a mythic enemy in many instances. And that led to the fact that, you know, a lot of Jews said that we should have a state of their own. I mean, look, on a very abstract level, you know, anybody can sympathize with that, you know, sentiment, you know, on the level of, you know, we should protect ourselves, have our own state, you know, as a self-defense posture. But the problem with it is that also Europeans were not ready, for instance, to displace any white Europeans within Europe to create a state for Jews, European Jews. So all the thinking about, you know, having a state was always, you know, part of this colonial mentality where that saw the land of other peoples as one that Jews, European Jews, can go and claim, force themselves on, invest in, and then displace the original inhabitants. In our case, Palestine was chosen for strategic, imperialist, and other reasons as a place where the Jews would enact or resurrect the state. Of course, within this kind of, you know, atheistic leadership of, and it's important to mention that they're atheists because they didn't, you know, believe in Judaism itself. They're secular Jews who did not believe in God, but also claimed that this land is their land based on the presence of, you know, Jews in the Holy Land at some point in our history. And I just want to, you know, remind people, because I think Palestinians also have a problem with this, is that the entire history of Palestine is our history. You know, like, that's one of the issues that sometimes we tend to give up on, in a sense that when people mention that Jews were here, fine, yes, Jews were here, and we are their descendants. You know, we're the descendants of the Christians that were here. We're descendants of Jews. And the Jewish history that was here is our history. It's not, you know, necessarily anybody else's history. It's also our history. It's part of our blood. It's part of our makeup. It's part of our culture. It's a part of our dialect in terms of how the Arabic that we speak is tied to the previous languages that inhabited Palestine. Even Hebrew was an old Palestinian language. I mean, it's not the modern Hebrew that was constructed for the purposes of creating this nationalist state. So I don't think that even us as Palestinians recognize the importance of also not trying to say, oh, there were not Jews in Palestine, but in fact that is part and parcel of our own history and our own makeup historically. Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, it's not like Palestinians, as some would claim, you know, just came from all of a sudden from, you know, 1,400 years ago after Islam came into the region. That is not true. Most Palestinians were and remain Fallahin, you know, like peasants that, you know, lived in villages and didn't care much about who's controlling them because they lived within a very self-contained system. Very peaceful people, by the way, didn't have an army in their history. You know, were not known for their fighting prowess or their huge military and successive battles. Generally, this very, you know, very peasant society, some Bedouins, a mix of all the cultures and traditions and histories of peoples, Syriacs, Aramaics, Hebrewites, you know, Christians, Muslims that, you know, engulfed this land. And we're the inheritors of that, you know. It's not, you know, anybody coming from Europe claiming that that part, even if he has a religious connection to the land, doesn't mean that the land in any way is there. And I think what for me was interesting always that some, at least, Europeans recognize this. You know, somebody like Deleuze, for instance, writes more, you know, properly about how, first of all, Europe did not pay its debt to the Jews, that it's failing to pay its debt to the Jews. It's failing to take moral responsibility for what it committed against the Jews. And that's important, that by choosing this kind of course of the politics of debt, of backing Israel, Europe is also conveniently serving its own geostrategic political interest. It's backing a colonial state in the midst of the Arab world that provides some sort of security, whether mythic or real, on, you know, containing West Asia, containing the Islamic threat of having a militarist state within the Arab world that divides it, etc. Whether this is a real threat or a mythic threat, that is part of at least the equation that is placed here. It's also self-conveniently, you know, or supporting its own, you know, economic needs, relationship to the Arab world, specifically through the American Empire, in terms of the, you know, oil and the finances that tie the Gulf states with, you know, the U.S. And Israel plays a big role in all of this as well. So in many ways, it, you know, Israel is, or Europe is not choosing a way to actually pay debt to the Jews. It's choosing a way to self-serve its imperialist interest. It's choosing a way that absolves it by seeing its own victims becoming oppressors. It's also playing, you know, and ignoring the real pain and the historical narrative of the people who historically belong to this land and who remain steadfast on it and who remain, you know, as long as there is, you know, a Palestinian will say Palestine is for the Palestinians. And that's what Deleuze, for instance, recognized. An indigenous population was displaced to create the space for a Jewish state, which means that we're not paying our debts to the Jews as Europeans. And it means that now we've turned also another people into victims of Europe, embodied in the figure of the Palestinians, which means that, that now there's two debts that, in fact, Europe has to pay. And of course, our debt, it's still not recognized, and there's no monuments around it, and there's no history around it, and there is no, you know, politics, if you want, around it. But I think, you know, we'll see how history moves, but I think one day will come when, you know, Europe will also have to reckon with its own moral responsibility for supporting and sustaining this ethno-national state that has ethnically cleansed and attempted to wipe Palestinians on multiple occasions, continues to do this through this ongoing Nakba, as we say, or this ongoing ethnic cleansing campaign. It still haven't done it, but I think it's also an important point for Europe itself to reckon with the fact that at this particular moment in history, it did not even really meet the moral responsibility with its own crime, because it's chosen this very perverse way of paying its own debt. You know? A very, you know, so I think that's at least one element of it as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the kind. I mean, this was brilliant, but it's the kind of debt that you can only pay by making sure this never happens again, and so doing anything other than ensure that it never happens again just accumulates that debt. But I think it's really important that you made the point that also while guilt and debt are factors in Europe's endorsement and direct support of Israel's genocide in Gaza, which also is not limited to Israel's genocide in Gaza, but Israel's settler colonial project throughout Palestine in general, which didn't start 3 months ago. I mean, Europe has always been an active partner in that. But Shaka Jarrar, an associate editor of Hibir, an independent Jordanian magazine, recently made the brilliant point in a piece he wrote in Arabic about, I'm going to quote from it because it's really brilliant. And I think particularly because we're talking about Europe and guilt. Guilt is not really an element in the US support for the Zionist project. And what Shaker says is that American political and military leaders are, I'm quoting here, American political and military leaders are directly involved in overseeing the battle. American weapons flow to Israel via an uninterrupted military air bridge, a physical embodiment of the bridge that the colony represents as an extension of Western and American interests in our region. No friendly or enemy eye can mistake today that the United States is in the heart of the war, and that is what it is doing. It's not biased or supportive, as it is waging the battle on its own behalf, not on behalf of Israel. So I really think, you know, I really wanted to mention this point that one, you know, Shaker writes, one no longer needs to muster a lot of evidence to say that the United States is not an ally of the enemy of the Palestinian people, but rather it is the enemy of the Palestinian people, as it is the enemy of all the peoples of this region. We got, you know, I got a little carried away. But I think this is important because you mentioned throughout, you know, your descriptions here, the various contradictions within how the Zionist project views itself. It's indigenous, but it's also colonial, and it's a, you know, they left Europe as settlers, but they arrived in Palestine. They left Europe as refugees, but they arrived in Palestine as settlers. Also, Israel's constantly trying to sell itself as the safest place for Jews in the world. It's so safe and so important to have so that Jews in Brooklyn and other places all over the world can have a spare country at the expense of the native Palestinian population. But at the same time, it is always already victimized in a region of Arabs that constantly are bidding for its demise. So these are all the contradictions that are constantly playing in the Zionist imagination of itself. And I think that, I mean, I don't know how much you would assign these contradictions to the ongoing, I mean, Israeli hysteria of killing everything that moves in Gaza. I mean, of course, part of this is the strategic and military defeat that the Palestinian resistance dealt Israel on October 7th. But also there is something to be said about the failure of the Israeli military's own response. I mean, we are learning now, the Electronic Intifada has been publishing a lot. This is a topic that has been completely ignored in mainstream media. I mean, it's even starting to get acknowledged in liberal media in Israel, that Israel killed what seems to be a lot of their own civilians on October 7th. How much do you think this is? I mean, we're shifting gears a little bit, but do you think that this initial frustration of their own actions, of killing their own people and being responsible for a lot of the carnage that's happened in the kibbutzim, particularly in kibbutz Be'eri, how much do you think this is contributing to their hysteric response in Gaza? And I also want to mention something else. I want you to talk about these two things together. You wrote this fantastic piece, in Rusted Radishes, a Beirut literary and art journal. The essay was titled Crosshairs, but I much preferred the title of the episode that you were on Millennials Are Killing Capitalism, The Sniper's Gaze, or The Gaze of the Sniper. And you wrote, I'm going to quote here, "The sniper is like a lone onlooker who inspects from the shadows. He enjoys the detachment from his subjects, akin to a spectator witnessing a couple's squabble. He briefly perceives them as mirror images of his own petty disputes with his lover. We are all distant observers at times, casually watching with delight a stranger in a cafe or noting a neighbor's late arrival. The sniper's first pleasure is the pleasure that distance allows. Yet the sniper's kinship with his target ends where his livelier role begins. With chilling precision, he selects his mark, keenly attuned to the impending kill. In his imposition, he finds a dark pleasure as he stubbornly cosplays the angel of death. Despite his role within a rigid military hierarchy, he singularly claims credit for his actions, convinced of his unique artistry and the mastery of his craft. Like a poet who relishes in obscurity and seclusion, the sniper thrives on the stories of others, while remaining on the spectator god bench. Returning to the sanctum of the barracks, the euphoria starts to erode, and perhaps only then does he contemplate the justification of his performance. Are his targets less than human or merely foes? Could they be mere skeletons lacking souls? Sometimes the mere pleasure of a successful hit surpasses the need for queries or moral reckoning." I mean, since the beginning of Israel's extermination campaign in Gaza, there's been a lot of admission, a lot of teeth out moment you know, moments from Israeli society of their own viciousness. There's been this like shameless admission of how completely dehumanized dehumanizing they are of Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, experts have been saying that this is one of those times where actually genocide or the intent to commit genocide is not really difficult to prove, because Israeli leaders, military leaders, pundits, journalists have been so out in the open about how completely dehumanized they see Palestinians. There's, you know, we all remember the very disturbing video of Israeli children singing for the annihilation of Palestinians in Gaza. This is a video that the Electronic Intifada captured after it was posted on Israel's public broadcaster, Kan. And the Electronic Intifada subtitled and posted the video, which was posted by Israel's public broadcaster and then deleted. But then YouTube removed it from our channel. There's also been this TikTok video going around of a lady who claims to be part of the Israeli army. And it's also an extremely disturbing video. It was watched by many people. And she is, you know, this video was live. It was recorded live. She's sitting with another lady and they're talking to, I think, an Arab man. And she expresses that she, you know, she's very proud of the fact that she killed two Palestinians. And when she's confronted and she's, you know, she's asked by this man, you know, you're proud of killing two Palestinians. And there's this very disturbing pleasure in her face where she says, I want to kill more, more, more. Eddie Cohen, who is an Israeli so-called journalist, had a poll on his Twitter or X account the other day where he contemplated and asked his followers what they think of the idea of assassinating Wael al-Dahdouh, the Al Jazeera chief correspondent in the Gaza Strip, who Israel killed multiple members of his family in October. I mean, there is something to be said. I want you to talk about this in contrast with what we mentioned earlier about this Israeli pleasure and jouissance that they seem to derive from the killing of the Palestinian. I mean, I'd like you to define this term jouissance that I just used. I'm probably mispronouncing it, because it seems to be a fundamentally insatiable desire that the Zionists have towards the killing of the Palestinian. And I think, you know, this can be said about, I mean, the Israelis seem to be enacting a fundamentally insatiable fantasy through the killing of the Palestinian. I mean, we see this with the campaigns of assassinating Palestinian literary giants and poets and academics and literateurs and scientists and doctors. They're really assassinating Gaza's intelligentsia. And an example of this is Israel's murder of beloved writer, educator, and mentor, Rifat al-Ara'ir. I mean, there was just something just unbelievably disturbing where it was not enough that they assassinated him, but they even tried to go a step further and commit a character assassination even after his death. And there seems to be this this dissatisfaction where, fundamentally, because Palestinians and their enemy, the Zionists, have a complete disagreement over what this death can produce. Palestinians know, to some extent, that death is not the end, that they are, you know, waging a war of liberation against their enemy, where Israel refuses to learn the lesson that killing Palestinians is not going to put them down to their knees and make them beg for the resistance to stop. In fact, it is only going to fuel them to resist more until the Zionist enemy is defeated. Can you talk about where this pleasure comes from? It's been completely inexplicable to me. I mean, historically, oppressors have tried to hide their crimes. the Israelis have entire Telegram channels where they boast of their crimes. They share pictures and very disturbing pictures and videos of mutilated Palestinian bodies. Can you explain what kind of illness is at play here?
I mean, look, we underestimate, you know, the fact that Israelis are subconsciously or unconsciously aware that they stole somebody else's land. No? Like we tend to, you know, think that because they have this narrative, because they have this ideology around it, because they feel that they're indigenous because of, you know, Jewish claim or Jewish history or bringing forth the Bible. I think there's a lot of, you know, evidence also that points out that when Israelis are kind of honest with themselves about the character of their enemy, which is in this case the Palestinian, that they realized, yeah, we're going to do an injustice because we're taking somebody else's land. And that's a fact that many of them have placed front and center with a lot of racism, of course. I mean, they're backward people, we're going to develop it, or they're, you know, they're people that are undeserving of this land, or people that are that would ruin it. We're going to turn it into a blooming oasis in the midst of a big desert. Or although Palestine has parts that are more deserty, it's actually not a desert. Anyways, I mean, my own take is that when you're a thief, I mean, and you're caught, you know, I think that a lot of people tend to double down on their theft. That's one element of it, psychologically speaking. In a sense, if I can make my theft legitimate by making the person I stole from admit that it's my land, that's why there's an obsession within the Israeli political discourse of getting Palestinians to always symbolically surrender. It's not enough that Mahmoud Abbas, for instance, security cooperates. It's not enough that Mahmoud Abbas, for instance, you know, sustains a political system that makes possible the expansion of illegal settlements in the West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas has to also, you know, recognize that Israel is both Jewish and, is a state for the Jews only, for instance, or a Jewish state, you know. The PLO recognizes Israel's right to exist, but no, there's need to be more recognition, always more recognition. Of course, it's politically expedient as well, because you don't want negotiations, etc. But it has also this deep-seated element of always getting the Arab and the Palestinian to admit that we are undeserving of this land, or that we're happy to live within your domain and within your sovereignty. That we don't have any political claim, and so if they can get this from us, maybe they can ease this sense of hatred they feel towards themselves for having stolen it. And for me, I think it's very important that this is centered, because I think in my encounters, even personally, when the Israeli sees a Palestinian, not everybody, I'm not talking about everybody, I'm not talking about everybody's experience, but I think that is part of the anxiety that a Palestinian brings forth only by being seen by an Israel. The idea that there's somebody else on this land that is disrupting my own sense of security, that my sovereignty is now whole and complete. So killing me physically as a Palestinian, or killing me symbolically, is something that I need. So I need to turn this Palestinian who claims Palestine into, I don't know, a citizen that would obey the law and will be happy. And whenever he says anything to object, I'll tell him, go to Syria, go to Gaza, go to, as they do with the Palestinian citizens of Israel. Or, in Gaza, where you're turned into a confined space, where economy is determined for you, where you have the siege alongside Egypt, and you claim because of some sort of threat that exists in the strip in terms of the resistance, etc., that you're gonna create this siege and sustain it without looking for any political solution. Remember that one of the elements that Israel is incapable of learning, as you claimed, is that, you know, there's no political solution to this for them. There's only a military solution to us. There's only a security solution. And there's never a real discussion within Israeli society about a political solution. And when it happened, they killed the person that even dared to open it, which was Yitzhak Rabin. They assassinated him, you know? I'm not saying that Yitzhak Rabin was a hero of the Palestinians. He wasn't. He was a Zionist. He didn't want the full Palestinian state to come into being. He saw Oslo as a convenient agreement. But even when you had this small current within some of Israel's intelligentsia and elite, and specifically its old Ashkenazi elite, that saw, okay, we got 77% of the land. We have now a weak Palestinian side embodied in the PLO that claims to represent the Palestinians, exiled, and they want to return to Palestine. And now we have an opportunity, historic opportunity, after the first Intifada, to try to find a territorial solution that is guarantees our existence for a long time and also meets some of the demands of the Palestinians. But the minimal demands. And we can at least through peace create a new horizon for the sustainment of Israel. But even that, I think in Israeli society, there was still those that saw that Israel will only be complete when it finishes cleansing the West Bank, the Galilee, the Naqab even. I remember, a lot of the Ben-Gavir people, they also want to kick out the Palestinian citizens of Israel. They want to cleanse people from Gaza. They want to cleanse people from the West Bank. But I do believe that even if that happens, let's imagine that all the Palestinians disappear, that will not be the end of it.
No, why is it there? Like, you know, there's Jordan, there's Syria, there's like all kinds of places.
There's a very important spatial, expansive desire as well that goes along with this. I mean, it doesn't speak to every current within Zionism. Some are more happy to stay within the confines of Tel Aviv and on the beach and say that this is ours and, you know, let's divorce from the Palestinians and have a two-state solution and stuff like that. But in many instances, there's always going to be a current and a powerful current within Israel that sustains its form of securitization, that is going to be the biggest supporter of its militarism. I mean, remember that even in Gaza, many of the people or the soldiers that are being killed come from this nationalist now religious current. You know? Mm-hmm. They come from the West Bank settlements. They come from the frontier areas. And they're overrepresented in the regular military. They're overrepresented in the intelligence. They're overrepresented in every security branch within the Israeli state, beyond some that they still haven't penetrated well, because there's also a war of, you know, if you want, position happening within the Israeli state, where strategically a lot of the settler movement people are positioning themselves in places of power. And part of that is through this elite combat units that a lot of, you know, the more liberal Israelis are moving away from, to like AI and high-tech warfare from Tel Aviv sanitized boardrooms. So they're doing the programming that feeds into also their career later on in terms of, you know, going into the civilian sector of high-tech. While the people that are doing the combat, a lot of them come either from the more marginalized groups within the Israeli state and society, or from this very ideological group, the national settler group, who are overrepresented in combat units like the Golani and the Nahal and others. What I'm trying to like at least lay out is that there's a never-ending expansionism embedded also within Zionism. Now, does it have to always be professed? No, but will it still sustain itself historically to the extent that even if it has a very successful project where it silences all Palestinians and get us all to symbolically surrender or to physically leave or get killed, whatever the options that they're giving us now, that expansion will continue. And I think, to me, that's why the settler religious nationalist sector represents a form of foreclosure. It's one of the most important elements, at least, of the ideological developments within Zionism itself, because I think by embodying itself or embedding itself within religious discourse, then it doesn't have to do any kind of weightlifting when it comes to logic or human rationality. It can foreclose any claim to its land, expansion, to its view of the world through this very religious lens. And it could sustain the Zionist project through this religious lens that always existed, even if it's in secular format. But now we have people that truly believe it, you know, that truly actually take it to heart, take it literally, and profess it in a way that forecloses. Like, I don't care what, you know, any rational argument is made by two humans on the basis of the historical ownership of the land, whatever it is. There's that godly metaphysical element that imbues me with the right to this land, and then I can foreclose my theft in this way. For a lot of the liberal, more progressive Zionists, the choice was either to dehumanize the Palestinians, to not see them as a people in a political sense, or even in a cultural, civilizational sense, so to demonize us in this way. In many ways, to turn us into an enemy and an obstacle that needs to be overcome while maintaining some sort of empathy and sympathy to our position. That, you know, we're going to do you an injustice, but doesn't matter. We're going to do it anyways, no? So that was one of the elements. We're going to do it because we need to do it. This is how, you know, this is how we solve our own problem, our own history. And it's going to come on your expense, and you just have to, you know, accept it because we're more powerful and more stronger and more equipped militarily in a military sense. And we're going to fight, and we're going to develop all these technologies that will sustain our domination and persist through it. Of course, this is a big illusion, because that's what happened exactly on 7th of October. That barrier, that sense of security fell. And it fell in a way that never fell before, in a sense that in all of the history of Zionism, at least since its beginning, yes, there was always violence. And there's always, you know, episodes of intense violence since, you know, 1919, if you want, until today, and even before then, between the Palestinians and the Zionist movement. But for the first time, after claiming through what is called the War of Independence, or what we Palestinians call the Nakba, which was an offensive action by the Zionists themselves, mostly, you know, expanding their space, cleansing villages, etc. And it was a difficult war. A lot of Zionists were killed in that war, 6,000, I think, something like that, the number. So it was a bloody, you know, war that resurrected what is now the state of Israel, but it was still an offensive maneuver by them. This was the first time that, despite all of the sense of security that they had, a very big opening occurred in their own sense of invincibility and power. It is as if, you know, everything they foreclose, whether through, you know, ideologically or materially or in terms of its own security apparatus, just opened. And in that moment, that opening, you saw the entire Zionist society become genocidal, become highly, you know, thirsty for killing, because that's the only way they can feel secure again. It's not a revenge, by the way. It's not it's not a vengeful pathology in a sense of, you killed us, we're going to kill you. It goes deeper than that. I mean, I think vengeance, you know, we could have said that vengeance plays a role in some sort of, on some, you know, on some level. But I think it is not vengeance. It goes deeper than vengeance in the sense that this pleasure that you called in killing, this pleasure in seeing Palestinian pain, this pleasure of playing God, this pleasure of choosing on Twitter or Facebook if we should kill Wael Dahdouh or we shouldn't kill Wael Dahdouh. This sense of unbridled power, not having enough, killing and not having enough with killing, not stopping. You know, like there's always a moment, even in any massacre, you know, there's a moment that people stop. And there's a lot of stories, even from the 7th of October, where, you know, Israeli civilians talk about Palestinian fighters almost killing them, but then letting them go. Or like, there's a moment where you like, you know, even if you're in like this fest of killing, you know, sometimes people do tend to also stop or, you know, feel like a sense we had enough. No? But I think from what happened from 7th October, when it comes to the Israelis, there's this kind of like very deep desire for a long time. It has been repressed to get rid of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian problem. And 7th of October opened that desire and need again in a way that we haven't seen for a long time. It opened it up, it made it a collective desire and need. And I think, you know, in Israeli showrooms and media, the only discussion is that about, you know, should we have killed from the beginning 100,000 or should we kill 20? Like, there's that kind of politics of rhetorical surpassing of each one saying, should we create plagues? Should we get people to get sick? Should we make them hungry more? You know, there's all of the elements going into this, this deep repressive, repressed desire to get rid of us that for a long time, Israel had, since 1948, had to accept the fact that there are Palestinians that live within its boundaries and that it cannot now do any sort of ethnic cleansing campaign for international reasons, for moral backing, for whatever it is. Now that all opened up. You guys wanted to change the equation. Now we're going to change it. And now we're going to create this Nakba. We're going to roll the Nakba. We're going to destroy everything. We're going to... Yeah. I mean, that's what I was trying to say, at least in on that, is that, yeah, 7th of October presented this opening where a lot of this kind of repressed feeling of seeing the Palestinian and being burdened by this feeling that there's somebody else on this land that, you know, reminds you of your theft, whether it's subconsciously or not. That now it's the moment that you can just, you know, if this Palestinian disappears, then perhaps I can feel better with myself, you know? and feel a need of, and that's what happens, and that's why you see a discourse even among people within, for instance, Haaretz and, you know, leftists, very ideological. I mean, the entire enterprise becomes very devoted in terms of backing the military operations, talking about military successes that are, generally speaking, over-exaggerated and overblown to sustain the campaign, talking about the destruction of the entire Gaza Strip and destroying much of its built environment in a way that doesn't justify any that is not justified militarily speaking, let's put it that way. Mass killing of people within their homes, purposefully and also without any military objective. Because what we're discovering, and this is one of the things that people don't say much about, is that the entire apparatus of resistance, most of it exists under the ground. So all these buildings are destroying, all these roads that they're, you know, they're actually, most of them are just civilian targets. They have no, they don't even have any kind of military objective whatsoever. It was a mass killing of civilians from air. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because there's a space, there's a separate space under the ground for the resistance. So what it tells us that, at least from framing this, and for me, it's important to situate and recognize that the Israelis recognize that they are thieves. They do recognize that. I don't take the point that through this ideological maneuvering and jiggling that they don't think between themselves at night before they sleep that they have installed in this land. They might be indifferent to it. They might have racialized it in a way that it makes them feel better, but they might have foreclosed it religiously. They might have created whatever ideological apparatus that supplants or supports this notion that this is our land in framing it, or this is a need, a Jewish need based on our memory or vulnerability of having a state of our own, an insurance policy. So if Europeans turn mad again that we have a state outside of Europe that can preserve our existence, all of that is fine, that exists, but they do recognize that at the same time that they're thieves and that they've stolen the land from its indigenous people. And the only way they can feel better about that theft and not being exposed for them being thieves is by killing Palestinian subjectivity itself, whether through rendering us people who do not have any political subjectivity whatsoever, except within the domain of Israel, that accept it and live within its boundaries as a defeated individuals, dispersed with no political claim, or by taking out even the mere physical presence of Palestinians from the window. And I think that's why it's so easy, it's so acceptable for even the U.S. and others to see its own state ally, its own, that is bringing it ahead again. So I agree with Shaka, for instance, in what you said. But what Israel is doing is also bringing headache to the American empire. I mean, the American empire, of course, is part of this war and wants the security of the state of Israel, wants to sustain the state of Israel. But they could disagree on the method of doing that, of how do you sustain Israel? How do you preserve it? What form of political solution can you? So there's forms or places of disagreement. And I think right now, also, the state of Israel is embarrassing its ally. But it's almost as if it's acceptable. Like, look, go do your evil. And we're just going to look the other way around and pretend nothing is happening and back you up. I mean, that's the relationship that is at least occurring publicly for us. We don't know what's happening in closed rooms. But at least publicly, that's the relationship between Biden and Netanyahu. You know, pretending that there's really military targets around, you know, the mass killing of civilians and all of that that is happening. So I do agree with Shaker that, you know, the empire wants to sustain Israel for its own, you know, accumulation of an extraction of surplus for its own, historical and cultural affinity through also this feeling that, America is a settler society, so Israel is a settler society. So there's that kind of like historical echoing happening as well. There's also this Christian Zionism that is imbued within American culture that is also, you know, displaced onto Israel as the state that will bring the Jews together, and there's going to be a war of Armageddon and all the Jews will be killed, and it's a very anti-Semitic position, but Netanyahu has no problem with it. But there's also a lot of, geostrategic interest tied to sustaining a state that divides the Arab world, that prevents the Arabs from having concrete real sovereignty, remaining countries that are highly dependent on American and European power and neocolonial policies. You know, so there's a lot of different elements to this and a lot of different theories. And to be honest, I never really took a position. I think there's an amalgamation of this, but for me, it always seemed inflated, you know, in many ways, because also you can make a very good argument that Israel is a burden on the empire. That even from an imperial, there is that argument, for instance, Mersheimer and Wolt make it. No, they make that the only reason the U.S. supports Israel in the way that it supports it has to do with just electoral politics and lobby, the lobby as a factor that provides an obstacle. So there's a lot of different, theories of why America has that kind of support and sustained support for Israel. It's different than Europe, of course, indeed. It's less burdened by, you know, issues of moral responsibility and collective guilt. And it has to do with empire and empire management, as well as these different layers, electoral, cultural, that we have spoken about and historical. And it sustains a relationship that at its heart also views the Palestinians as an obstacle, as a people that need to be rendered homeless. A solution needs to be found for the predicament, but at the end of the day, the priority is always given to the state of Israel and its existence, even on the expense of the Palestinians. The Americans haven't developed a lot of guilt around that, around what they have committed against the Palestinian people through this unbridled support that they give Israel, and through, they haven't developed, but you see it sometimes. You see it even among some of the policymakers. There's some unease with what's happening with us, but again, it's like that, it's a necessary evil. You know, you're just in the wrong place and you need to be taken out. Or we don't want to listen to you too much because you disturb our own sense of place. Or they, of course, demonize you by turning you into an anti-Semitic, you know, or Nazi or Amaleks, or it depends on the strategy they want to create to make themselves feel better again about theft. And I think this is, for me, you know, the central component of all of this. I don't think you steal something and you're not aware you don't steal. I just don't believe that. No?
Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, you reminded me of this interview that the New York Times did with, I watched it like on an Instagram reel. And it was an interview with, I think it was two or three settlers who lived in the colonies near, in the south, near the Gaza Strip, where Palestinian resistance, penetrated a lot of these colonies on October 7th. And in the video, I mean, you know, not denying that Palestinian resistance fighters killed Israeli civilians that day, but in the video, you know, they're describing the horror of it, and they're describing, you know, they're saying it was so horrific. But they, you know, one of them explains that Palestinian resistance fighters were in her house for many hours during that day. And she does not claim that they laid a finger on their heads, you know. But she does say that at some point she was so afraid that she prodded her husband, who was carrying a weapon, that he should just shoot her and their children in the head and get it over with. And this is the only invocation of violence throughout the entire video. The interview with this woman is that she is calling for her husband. She doesn't even claim that the Palestinian resistance fighters attacked them or hurt them physically. In the same video, the interview with these settlers, the moment that she starts crying was when she says, what was so painful that day, what was most painful that day, I don't remember exactly what she said, I'm paraphrasing, was how they moved around like they owned the place. And that to me was a great admission of exactly what you're describing, which is, this is precisely what tickled and opened the wound of Zionism, is that there was this stark realization that you can pretend to own the land until your eyes turn blue, but ultimately, when you know you're living so close to a caged population of 2.3 million people who you've never interacted with in your life, and in your life, you know, this was a woman who seemed to be, I mean, she's a grown woman. She's definitely been alive for more than 17 years, the length of Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip. She must have witnessed Gaza being bombarded with Israeli bunker buster bombs over the years, the many, many massacres that happened in Gaza, 2008, 2009, 2012, 2014, and I'm only mentioning the major ones. This was probably the first time that she's seen a Palestinian, okay, unless she's been to the West Bank, walking around an Israeli colony. And it was the first time she probably realized that ultimately this is what someone who owns the land looks like, right? And I think that's precisely what made it so emotive and so disturbing to her, because it's just, you cannot wake a lion who's pretending to be asleep no matter how much you try. You know, you cannot feel that this land is yours when you have the internal and explicit and eternal knowledge that no matter how many children you have that are born here, you came here as settlers and you stole someone else's land. And that's the only way you were able to establish those colonies. So I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, when I asked you this question about insatiability and the insatiable fantasy of Israeli settlers, I think you historicized it and contextualized it very well by talking about the insatiability for land. You know, this is really what it comes down to. I did not ask that question out of any interest. You know, I'm radically disinterested in the moral rot of Israelis. I think moral rot is historically uninteresting. What really interested me about it is the psychological rot of boasting about it, of being so completely, of deriving such, you know, sick pleasure from the killing of the native population. But it's fundamentally, and I'm glad you brought us back to the materiality of it. It's a material insatiability for more land, which is something that can be said. You know, Israel is not unique in that. Israel is a settler colonial project that is a blueprint of other settler colonial projects in other places. What makes this a unique case is that it's one of the last remaining settler colonies that have not completely taken over and can still, you know, be defeated and reversed. Well, tell me.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think like it's, I mean, there was a historical element to it because Jews were deprived in Europe from agriculture. No? I mean, so Zionism was supposed to build this relationship with land. The Kibbutzim was a movement that was basically this kind of like a Jewish yearning to be at one with land, not to be the city dweller, but to be the agricultural peasant that works in the land, that, you know, builds a new state through his own enmeshment and labor with land. And that also that labor with land will mean that at some point you will own the land. You know? Like it's also a colonial, you know, colonial construction of ownership of land that has to do with whoever works on the land owns it. You know, it goes to Locke and others who placed front and center, you know, the relationship between labor and time and effort placed on the land with owning it, or with the idea of why people have the right to ownership. Of course, with Locke and others, there's always been a dismissal of other peoples. So, you know, who you include and fold within the people is a very limited sense. And that's why I think Zionism is an inheritor of all the worst tendencies of racialized systems of exclusion. And ideologies of exclusion that, you know, exists and continue to exist in Europe. And now, not only is Zionism an inheritor of these ideology, it's also the place where new racialized systems of control, exclusion are created and then exported to the empire. So you have now in the Zionist movement a place for new ideological innovations that are both, you know, created within the interaction that Zionism has with the Palestinians, and then also appropriated for other places, other contexts, whether within the metropole itself, meaning in the center, in the U.S., in Europe, or across the globe as well, materially, but also ideologically speaking. So it has that also role that it plays. But again, I think, to me, when we talk about the pleasure of killing, of course, it has to do with this October 7th. But it's not only about October 7th. Of course, that this kind of opening where this kind of like unconscious, subconscious, but also conscious desire that is always part of Israeli discourse in its media about the figure of the Palestinian and rendering this figure invisible. What you can see it in the wall that separates, you know, Israelis from Palestinian villages, is that, you know, even the wall tries to wipe out, you know, the view of the village, the view of the existence of the Palestinian people behind the wall. So if you live in Tel Aviv and you just go to the north and the south, you can almost live without any kind of knowledge of Palestinian villages just across 5 kilometers or 10 kilometers from your home. And with little interest in that world or the occupation that exists or in the settlements and the settlers that also, you know, you can completely be devoid of that and feel comfortable in this modern state. And the wall on their side is actually beautiful. It's tiled. It has drawings. On our side, it's like, you know, ugly, aesthetically unpleasing, at least in terms of when you look at it, you feel caged, you feel etc. But, you know, it tells you quite a lot about how all of these self-defense mechanisms almost, you know, get exposed just simply by how the militarist side of Israel, once it's broken, you know, everything else just pops up, you know. And that's why this is a desire to feel safe again, through killing more and more Palestinians, to feel secure again, to feel like you're not a thief, to feel that the real owners of the land don't have a chance to actually reclaim their land and live on it. That needs a massacres, that needs a lot of killing, and that needs the wholesale destruction of the Palestinian people. But to be honest, I never thought that Israel was not doing that. It was always doing that, but it was doing it in a very slow, sometimes contradictory way, in ways that sometimes produce unintended consequences that did not calculate, and then it had to deal with because, you know, they fail at planning. Sometimes they fail in terms of how they organize their own settler colonial project and the retake and the expansion of their own state, and it creates their own internal contradictions, etc. But, you know, I think that it's always funny when people who have a secret get the secret exposed, how they interact with it. And I think that's also this relationship between a secret shame that you have and getting exposed is operative in terms of what happened in the past month and how sometimes many people, when they have a truth exposed that they held near and dear, and then suddenly it opens up and becomes a scandal, they double down with the lying. They double down with what they knew that they should be doing from all along. What Benny Morris, for instance, says in his own book, after studying the ethnic cleansing campaign of 1948, 1947, 1948, 1949, he says that the problem with Israel is that it did not complete the ethnic cleansing. So that was the mistake for Benny Morris. No? And I think that shows in a way that if we complete it, if we finish, if we, you know, maybe we can rest. Maybe we can now become whole. Maybe we can now be sovereign. Maybe nobody will claim Palestine as their own. And I think, you know, to be honest, I don't think that will ever happen for the Israelis. They will never, you know, be in a situation where they feel rest assured that their robbery is now recognized as legitimate or as normalized. I don't know. History works in different ways. Mm-hmm. But I think that will always, as long as they're Palestinians, as long as they're people who claim this land, as long as there's an Arab world that is also, you know, has a history of antagonism, despite any kind of immediate meaning of interest based on current power dynamics and geopolitics. The Israelis, if they want to live in this region and be part of it, you know, they will have to, you know, reckon with their own history and be more humble, because you know, in the medium run, in the long term, they have really very little chance of sustaining their presence here, because you know, power ends, things change in the world. One day you're on top, the next day on you're on the bottom, you know. And you know, could be 100 years, it could be 200 years, it could be 300, who knows. But you know, in the end of the day, the way dynamics operate historically with anybody, and this is what for me is, you know, quite amazing and perhaps tragic about the Zionist movement itself, specifically its relationship to Judaism, because Judaism has this deep historical, you know, relationship to a tradition that sustained itself throughout the years, through religious teaching, of course, and, you know, this lively Talmudic learning, etc. But also, you know, at some point through this kind of critical posture that many Jewish intellectuals took against the Enlightenment and its project, because they were this internalized anemic other, and because they were also excluded from, you know, the same rights as the white Christian European. I mean, there's a long history of this historical consciousness among the Jewish people, specifically 3,000, 3,000, 4,000. I mean, and I think Zionism has distilled it to the just a simple equation. We need a state of our own that protects us from all the others. And that state needs to be bulletproof. And the tragic thing about it is also it was constructed in a region that, historically speaking, did not have and did not exhibit the same antagonism towards the Jewish people. No? It's not like Europe, yeah? I mean, of course, it doesn't mean there's no tensions. I mean, people, when they say that, oh, like, you know, Muslims and Jews have sometimes, of course, I mean.
Right, but it's not a systemic, like, it's a bug, not a feature. And in Europe, it's an absolute feature.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of also the equation that we were talking about. It's in a sense, not only Jews are, you know, European Jews are displaced outside of Europe, into Asia, into Western Asia, to create the state, but also we're going to displace the antagonism from this kind of, if we want to talk about it in terms of like these civilizational units. I'm not keen on talking about civilizational units, because I think they're constructs and they could change, etc. But at least in this kind of constructed, you know, European versus the other, the Arab, you know, and the Jew, who are also constitutive of what Europe is. And this is important to mention, that there's no Europe without this kind of internalized and external enemy, you know. These two operate together to create, you know, Europe as such. But beyond that element of speaking of how, you know, by displacing also Israel into the region and creating this Arab-Jewish antagonism, Islamic-Jewish antagonism, whatever you want to call it, is also kind of turning as if the historical, you know, issue of anti-Semitism is now displaced on the Islamic-Arab civilization. And that's how it's connected today, no? I mean, if you're Palestinian and you're unhappy that Israel was created on your land, you're anti-Semitic, no? And you're anti-Jewish. You know, you hate, supposedly you hate Jews because you don't want any people to come and, you know, and take your land or steal your land. And I always say this, I really couldn't give, you know, a damn who conquers Palestine. If it's French, they're French. If they're German, they're German. If they're, I don't know, some other people from Mars, I don't know. Whatever the people, whatever they say about themselves and about their claim, from purely Palestinian lens, we don't care.
They're an occupier, period.
They have, we're not invested or interested in their identity or history. It's not my issue. It's not, you know, we can study it because we are curious about these people that took our land, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we want to study them out of just understanding what they say about themselves and and how they construct their own, you know, narrative, etc. But we don't care. We don't care about, you know, their identity. It's not our investment. It's not something we care about. And people asking us this is asking us from us to be, you know, to prove that we don't hate Jews, or that we have this kind of embedded vile hatred of the Jewish people. You know, it's ridiculous. It's stupid, and I think it's in many ways a projection of their own historical hatred of the Jews.
100%.
It's displacing that onto us. And when they ask you that question, they themselves want to feel comfortable that their own hatred exists somewhere else, you know, and that they can feel better about not hating the Jews as much, perhaps, specifically if it's coming from white, you know, Europeans, who are obnoxiously still, many of them are anti-Semitic and anti-Arab. And I think, you know, that is, for me, undeniable. And that's why the choice, even with Germany, you know, backing Israel, is also, for me, a form of anti-Semitism that still persists in German policy. I mean, they could argue that against us. No, it's a way to redeem ourselves or pay a debt to the Jewish people. Fine. But I think it's a choice that you're making that is also in itself anti-Semitic, based on the fact that you're conflating Judaism with Israel and with the Zionism itself. And it's always important to just mention to people there's a lot of Zionists that are not Jews, and there's a lot of Jews that are not Zionists. Mm-hmm. By doing that, you're anti-Semitic, because that's the position you're taking. You're saying all Jews are Zionist, or all Jews have an interest or a stake in the Zionist movement. Again, you know, a Jew might just not care about this whole issue, or have a position against it. I don't know. So yeah, for me, I mean, I don't want to, like, you know, talk too much, but in essence, I think, we don't have an interest. I mean, I don't care, you know, what this Polish Central European Jew says about himself when he decided that this land is his land and he's going to take it from me. I mean, I really couldn't give a damn about that. I don't think it interests me even slightly, because I think in many ways, no matter who would have come to Palestine, and this is important, we never went to Jews and tell them, come here, let's, you know, come to Palestine so we can kill you. You know, that was not the equation. You know, we didn't, like, ask them, we didn't send them a message across the world, hey, come, because we hate Jews so much, please come to Palestine so we can engage in violence against you. And in fact, I do think that if Jews came as refugees that want to live with us, I don't think that Palestinians, I mean, there might be tension around any form of, you know, movement of population spatially in terms of, you know, how people interact together, but I don't think there will be this form of antagonism against against the takeover of Palestine that we've seen from the Palestinians when Zionism declared that it wants to take over Palestine. It's a different thing. The Zionists never came to Palestine to live with; they came to live instead. And in essence, that was an equation that is intolerable to the Palestinians. And, you know, eventually, it's going to be politically untenable for the Zionists. 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 100 years, 200 years, it's going to be politically untenable, because they're in a very particular region. And eventually, you know, they cannot sustain this on the expense of other people. Mm-hmm. It will demand a complete recalibration of the Arab and Palestinian imaginary to do that. And that is almost impossible. And no matter what political regime now normalizes with Israel, or because of Israeli power in the meantime, you know, that there's that dynamic of fear and the burden of death and killing and feeling a sense of being deterred by Israeli power. but this is always going to be temporary. You cannot sustain this forever. You cannot normalize yourself in the region on the basis of crushing the region. There's no normalization on that sense of placing 450 million people under your foot and thinking that you can sustain that forever. It's arrogant. It's stupid. It will never work. And I think, you know, October 7th just proved it, that it will never work. Mm-hmm. It proved it. It's not burning, perhaps, in Israeli consciousness, because they still killing will get them, you know, killing more Palestinians will get them out of this that happened. But I think at some point they will have to reckon with this fact. I mean, that's I think, the story of what happened since October 7th, is that they're still postponing the reckoning with their own limitations and the limitations of what a paranoid, neurotic political movement that knows that it has stolen land and forecloses it in different ways has to deal with. That military power will never be the only answer for the presence of Jews in the Middle East and how that presence can be constructed.
That was brilliant, Aboud. And the only thing I would add to that is a brilliant point that was made the other day by Asad Abu Khalil on Rania Khaliq's show, Dispatches, where he said that Palestinians, the Palestinian resistance movement, and even the Lebanese resistance movement have been very invested in recent years, in a way that they weren't before, in studying the Zionist enemy, learning the Hebrew language, and being able to intercept not just text but audio, and being able to understand it. This is something that Israel, until this day, refuses to do with Palestinians. They refuse to understand Palestinians. They refuse to understand what motivates Palestinians, and even if they do to some extent, even if their analysts do to some extent, they completely fail to understand that it's an impossible project to execute. In any case...
just one note. It's because they feel sometimes they're successful. That's why they fail. Because it's a matter of bias. Because they see somebody like Mahmoud Abbas who symbolically compromises. Who they can push over. And sometimes that gives you the sense that, okay, we can burn into their consciousness something. They can be defeated. We have the prisoner that we took and confessed. No, we tortured and confessed. We have this kind of, history of seeing, for example, some Arabs that live within the boundaries of Israel serving the Israeli army saying that they're Israeli now, or feeling a sense of belonging at some level to Israel. You know, there is some level to that, that they feel that they can be successful because they see the Emirates signing agreements with it, because they see Bahrain signing agreements with it. They see Saudi willing to take its secret relationship and bring it out in the open. They see more sympathetic or, let's say, political voices in the Arab world that, willing to cooperate with it. Sometimes an alliance of convenience, these new incomers from Europe, we have a problem with our neighbors, so they can maybe help with it. You know, like, for example, the Maronites or some of the Maronite right-wing, currents saw in Israel a sort of... an ally of convenience. They can help us at some critical junctures and points. But in general, despite the existence of forms of cooperation with Israelis, that they feel a sense of, it proves, okay, military power maybe produces somebody who's defeated. It produces sometimes political movements like Fatah, for instance, that used to lead the revolution, and now, it's a pitiful echo of its past. and has betrayed its past, in fact. Not everybody in Fatah, but, you know, at least its current leadership. So you have all of these elements interplay, and the Israelis can see them. That's why they insist on feeling that there's a sense of a triumphant Zionism that, at least for the past 10, 16 years, Netanyahu was very sympathetic, symptomatic of that. Because I think Netanyahu comes in power specifically, I mean, he was in power in the 1990s, but he comes in power after the 2006 Lebanon War that Olmert led. No? He comes after the Second Intifada, and he comes after, so the Palestinian issue was dealt a blow, at least in the West Bank, militarily speaking, and the resistance was defeated there. He comes after this equation of deterrence is created with Lebanon after the 2006 war. And he comes into power with not a lot of threats, in at least in the immediate sense of a threat. No? And he told the Israelis, I'm Mr. Security, because that was a secure era for a lot of different reasons. And because the major wars that you conducted in the beginning of the 2000s, you know, helped you at least for a while feel a sense of security. There were the wars in Gaza, but they were manageable from afar away. And Lebanon seemed deterred. You had the Arab revolutions. The Arabs were busy with themselves. You know, a lot of these different dynamics convinced the Israelis they're in a better position, the Abrahamic Accord, blah, blah, blah. And Netanyahu represented this kind of like Israeli feeling of security, feeling that we're in this moment that at the height of our power, with very little to worry about except some distant nuclear program in Iran, that Iran is hesitant to move to full. Lebanon, perhaps, but there's still this pain, this equation of pain, mutual pain that deters the Lebanese resistance. And Gaza is a manageable issue. And then comes 7th of October, breaking down. We have Abu Mazen, we have an entire current in the Arab world that supports us and backs us. So they still believe that they can repeat their own historical successes of creating this sense of defeat. But even among those defeated in Palestine, there's still a sense of melancholy that wants to retain Palestine at some level. I wouldn't bet on it that it's gonna, you know, come back to life, but people sustain the idea of Palestine. Nobody doesn't, you know, completely, want to kill it. People sustain some sort of notion, whether so that specter exists in most people, and knocking Palestine out of the Palestinian consciousness is a very tough business to do. And I think because of the enormity of the injustice done to us, it's very hard for all, also for us to transcend, you know, Palestine and think of a world without it, without reclaiming it. And that's why Palestinian subjectivity is generally, or Palestinian nationalism is a defensive mechanism. You know, I'm not into nationalism that much, but Palestinian nationalism has at least this element that is very self-defensive. And it could be that once you don't need this self-defense anymore, you don't need Palestine. You know, it exhausts itself Palestine doesn't need to turn to a state, for instance, like some people think. It could turn to something else. I don't know. Maybe it will be a new model for humanity. But I think that at least for me, precisely, I think that the Zionist project is like Sisyphus. It repeats the same action, but thinks it learns something. That's what's so dangerous about it. It thinks that it learns historical lessons, thinks it learns military lessons, but it repeats the same thing. And I think this is why we shouldn't give them a lot of credit about being a learning organization. Yes, they learn tactically. They learn from, they develop new technologies. They, you know, there are elements. I don't want to, bring forth as if Israel doesn't learn. But in a very overall sense, they don't. In a strategic overall sense, they don't. Whether it's, you know, socialist Zionist or whether it's religious Zionist, I don't think that there is a different element of really learning what to do with the Palestinians or how to live with or how to create a different condition that ensures that, you know, they don't maintain this form of superiority and oppressive system against the Palestinians, to the extent that we can say that perhaps Zionism in its essence needs somebody to oppress. Mm-hmm. And this is one element of what remains from the Holocaust, you know, burned in the consciousness of this historical victim that needs somebody to victimize, mm-hmm. that needs to avenge the SS guard by displacing, you know, the image of the SS guard onto Palestinian people. You know? It's funny because, for instance, now you have, it's not even funny, but, you know, now you have groups of settlers that chooses the word Nazi to describe Palestinians.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have the somebody called Gaza should be turned like Auschwitz. I think it was the deputy mayor of Jerusalem that claimed that, Gaza should be, you know, turned into Auschwitz. So you have these analogies, either that we're Nazis or we have to be encamped as the victims of the Nazis. Now, this is a very dangerous territory. It's like Palestinians are Nazis. It means that Palestinians supposedly are powerful, you know? Because at least in the historical relationship between National Socialism and the Jew, the Nazis were more powerful. They're the ones that control the state. They're the ones that conducted the Holocaust. So apparently they were in the power. So in this sense, by displacing this notion of being Nazi, you're placing me as superior, but at the same time, you want the Nazi to be in Auschwitz. You know? You want kind of this historical revenge to be conducted on somebody that has nothing to do with the Holocaust. It's a tragic sense, but that's how it's constructed. We're so powerful at the same time, and it comes up, and it's almost not only historic. I think it actually echoes a lot of like the mythology around anti-Semitism, this anti-Palestinian sentiment, where the Hajj Amin Husseini, as Netanyahu says, gave the idea of the Holocaust to Hitler. Like, you know, imagine, like, he turned the Palestinians to the ark. You know, to the symbolic, the symbolic other that is responsible for everything that happens to Jews. You know? Historically, even in things and episodes that we have very little or nothing to do with, like, you know, the killing, the mass killing of the European Jewry in Europe in the mid 20th century.
I mean, it's anti-Semitic. You're like absolving the real criminals by saying that.
Yeah, but it's not only anti-Semitic. It's anti-Semitic in absolving. It's also convenient ideologically. It's true. But it's also anti-Semitic in terms of, you know, projecting onto the Palestinian the same type of mythology about the powerful Jews, no? About the powerful Jews that control finance, that control... that control the world, that, you know, disrupt society. So the Palestinians suddenly become the secret symbolic other with a big O, you know, that is responsible, that knit all these different conspiracies against the Israelis and against the Jews in this case. And I know that it comes more out of a convenience of, you know, trying to link Palestinians to the Holocaust, trying to stigmatize us as part of that. But that convenience also tells us a lot about that attempt to displace on the Palestinian the figure of the anti-Semite, the figure of the Nazi, the figure of, you know, that is all being constructed all at once to justify theft, but also to enact a historical revenge against the Germans that the Israelis never actually enacted, except with the figure of Eichmann. They have never done that onto the Palestinians. And to keep killing the Palestinians as a sign of it, as a sign of their own sense of now they become, they can be secure, now they can feel a sense of invincibility that historically Jews, at least in the narrative of Zionists, never felt in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant, brilliant, Aboud. When you brought up the myth of Sisyphus,